Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-hosts, Alfred Adisk and James Corbett of the Corbett Report, will be here after the first segment of today's program. Today is Thursday, May 11th, 2017, so let's get started right away with the market report. I always like to get started with the market report real quick. Well, gold is up. Gold is up. 580 today. 580 for gold at 1225.60. You have silver up 13 cents today at $16.40. You have platinum up 5, 920. And you have palladium up 4 at 805. The U.S. index today is right now it's showing basically unchanged at 99.64. Crude oil was up 0.45 at 47.78. Paper markets today, they recovered somewhat. The Dow is only down 26 points. It was down almost triple digits earlier today. 20,916. The NASDAQ was down 14 at 61.14. The S&P was down 5 at 23.94. Euro still holding a 109, but it was down 0.06. What was the yield on the 10-year? 2.40. Down just a little bit, 0.01. And, hey, there's no more fear. The emotion driving the markets is moving right on up to the greedy part. 63, I think it was just a little over a week ago, it was at 38, 39. So, you know, America recovers very quickly from fear to greed. And again, it doesn't really mean anything. It just shows a little bit of a trend, what the markets are experiencing. And absolutely, there's been very little fear in these markets. And, you know, I think a lot of it is it's people have so much confidence that the infrastructure and all these plans are going to be going forward that there's this unusual unusual amount of optimism and confidence that things are going to follow through no matter what happens. And that kind of, you know, confidence at this period of time just doesn't fare well for a lot of people's investments, because that when they have that feeling, they don't do anything. They don't protect what they have. I've been asked 1,000 times over the past couple of days if we are experiencing a low for gold and silver. And absolutely, I do think we are. I mean, when you compare it to the upside potential, absolutely. I mean, you are looking at lows. Silver might fall a few more pennies. Maybe gold's going to fall a few more dollars, but how low can it go? The upside potential is so great. You can't squibble about a few pennies or a couple of dollars. The point is you can't time the markets. So yes, we are experiencing lows. I mean, I do expect to see 3,000 gold. I do expect to see $100 silver. And these are conservative estimates. I mean, heck, you have people out there claiming 50,000 gold and 1,000 silver. Maybe. Let's get to 3,000 first. Let's get to 100 silver. And then we can go from there and see what's happening at that point in time. Maybe at 2,000, we'll be able to predict, nope, gold's going to 5,000. It's not going to stop. But we don't know until we get to some higher levels. And but these are my estimates. I'm a conservative, and I give them a conservative estimates. But they're still great estimates. 3,000 gold, are you kidding me? 100 silver? That's great. And so if gold is going to 3,000, then gold at 2,500 is a pretty good buy. So you really can't time the markets. You really do have to see. The point is you have to buy. You have to get out of those paper dollars. You want to convert those paper dollars into real money. And so, yes, this is a great time. It's a great time to be buying gold and silver to eliminate that paper. So give us a call, 1-800-375-4188. 90% silver selling at some very low prices. A $25 face value includes shipping, $345. And so give us a call, 1-800-375-4188. The media, the Democrats, are still going crazy over the Comey firing. Tonight, Lester Holt on NBC will air his interview with Mr. Trump. And so I've read you know, some of the excerpts from the interview. And, you know, I think we probably already know the answers to and the questions. We pretty much know the questions and the answers to that interview. But I'm sure everyone will be tuning in. So, again, there's just so much name calling, so much, you know, calling the president crazy and so much. And you know what? Hopefully they'll be able to move on. But there is a lot of question on whether Sean Spicer will be holding his job any for much longer. But we'll see what happens. But in the meantime, we have weak sales at department stores. There's a growing concern that the biggest part of the economy, it's not picking up. How are they going to raise rates? You know, U.S. retail sales are due out tomorrow, but you had Macy's, Kohl's, Dillard's. They all reported lower sales for the last 3 months. They all missed Wall Street forecasts. And we have reported numerous times on this program the difficulty that these department store chains are having lately due to this intense competition from Amazon, even still from Walmart. And then you got new retailers also. Or maybe it's just a bad economy. Maybe people just don't have the money, any disposable income. The new Macy's CEO said in its earnings release that the company was encouraged by the sales of women's shoes, jewelry, and furniture in its stores. You know, I can remember going back to... prior to 2008, actually, I think it was going into the dot-com bust in the late 90s. And it was just like everybody was buying furniture. I mean, it was just like the furniture stores were popping up everywhere. I mean, you go into furniture stores, you'd have to wait 3 hours until somebody could wait on you. And it's like, how much furniture can people buy? It's the same with women's shoes. How many pairs of shoes can you have? You know, and jewelry. Yeah, jewelry is a little bit different. But again, you know, if you're getting fine jewelry or so forth, gifts, holidays and so forth, you know, we're going kind of going into that season where you have, I don't know, when you have, you know, brides and, you know, engagements, engagement rings and so forth. So, but again, they were encouraged. This is Macy's to see the... rise in sales of those. But overall, sales fell 7.5% from a year ago, and same-store sales, which measures how well stores open at least a year are doing, dropped more than 5%. So he did say that they are focused on trying to stabilize their brick-and-mortar business, but they're still going to invest aggressively to grow the digital and mobile business. So you had Macy's stock plunged nearly 15%. Shares of Dillard's fell 13%. Nordstrom, they're going to be closing after the bell today. Kohl's fell 6%. So not good for the retailers. Just an update on the Puerto Rico bankruptcy. They're going to begin their proceedings, their bankruptcy proceedings, on May 17th in San Juan with a series of requests for managing the case as the Commonwealth begins the process of restructuring its $70 billion in debt. You know, their bankruptcy may not immediately change the day-to-day lives of the people, 45% of whom live in poverty. But it's going to lead to cuts in pensions, worker benefits, and a reduction in health and education services, and that's going to hurt. This is still the largest ever U.S. municipal bankruptcy. It's dwarfing that of Detroit, and the island's economy, well, it's been in a recession for almost 10 years. Their unemployment rate is about 11%. And so those creditors are going to be imposed drastic discounts. You have holders of general obligation debt have declared their right to be paid first. Owners of sales tax bonds are squabbling with one another over who deserves priority, but they're all up against the Commonwealth leaders. And of course, they want to keep the money for Puerto Rico for essential services. know, simple things like water, electricity, you know, keeping their schools open. I mean, we reported last week they just closed 187 schools, 157 schools, a lot of them. So again, those proceedings will begin next week. Some good news. There was a major victory when the Arizona State Senate voted 16-3 to remove all income taxation of precious metals at the state level. The measure is going to head to the governor. He's expected to sign it into law. So the House Bill 20, and this has been going on for a while. We've reported on it here and there, but it is heading to the governor's desk to be signed into law. Taxpayers will simply back out all precious metals gains and losses reported on their federal tax returns from the calculation of their Arizona adjusted gross income. So, hey, people own gold to protect themselves against the devaluation of America's paper currency. So, and hey, you got to thank the Fed for the inflationary practices they love to do. So, you know, we know as long as they keep it up, as long as we have a Federal Reserve, as long as we have a monetary policy that isn't backed by gold, there's no accountability. I don't care if you bring back our deficit a little bit or whatever, the longer term inflation will always be there to eat up your purchasing power unless you get something that's real and will protect you. We've talked about this before, and it just keeps popping up in the news. Auto loan fraud soars. This is the fraud. You know, we talked about the subprime loans. Now we're talking about the fraud in the auto loan, how it's soaring, very parallel to the housing bubble. And borrower fraud in U.S. auto loans is surging and may approach levels seen in mortgages during the last decade's housing bubble. As many as 1% of U.S. car loan applications include some type of material misrepresentation. This is from executives at data analytics firm Point Predictive, estimated based on reports from banks, finance companies, and others. Lenders' losses from deception may double this year to $6 billion from 2015. Those fraud rates are coming closer to the over 1% level for mortgages in 2009 when the financial crisis was boiling and more lenders started reporting incidents to one another. I don't think car loans are the same as these mortgages, but still we're getting to levels and even the total amount of funds is getting close to the same levels as 2007 and 8. So again, this is another sign that we've just converted back to the same place that we were prior to the Great Recession. So again, another sign, another leaf in the breeze, another 2x4 to knock you on your head to say, hey, you know what, this can't continue. There's going to be a lot of turmoil this year. I mean, we've seen it. And it's only going to get worse. I saw in a headline today that, you know, things are great again, that the government posts $182 billion surplus in April. Now, you shouldn't get too excited about this announcement. Yesterday, we talked about dynamic scoring, and perhaps this is part of the equation that Warren Buffett had talked about. When he warned people to be wary of a trick the administration is about to use to make the federal budget look more balanced, dynamic scoring. The imagined benefits are added to future budget projections. And voila, you've got a healthy-looking balance sheet for America. And it might not be much different than when Clinton slapped a bunch of IOUs in the Social Security fund and everybody called it a balanced budget. But the federal government records $182.4 billion budget surplus. Treasury said that. It was yesterday. And this is the second largest surplus after a record $189.8 billion surplus that was set in April of 2001. Now, the government generally runs surpluses in April, reflecting the annual tax deadlines. But what makes this the second largest surplus? Well, this year's surplus was inflated because of a deadline change that allowed corporations until April to make their final tax payments for last year. The deadline had previously been March. Aren't we changing the calculations to make it look better than what it is? I mean, that's exactly what, you know, you hear about the dynamic scoring. They're changing. They added an extra month to make it look like things are better, that the debt deficit decreased. The first 7 months of the current budget year, the government is running a deficit of $344.4 billion. That's down 2.4% for the same period a year ago. The CBO's deficit estimate is based on current law remaining unchanged. President Donald Trump has called for a program of tax cuts for individuals and businesses and increased government spending in such areas as the military and repairing the nation's aging infrastructure. But the CBO hasn't been able to project just how much of an impact these proposals will have on this year's deficit or in the future, because so far, this administration has not released its full budget outline. And that's going to come later this month. So we can have a pretty big shakeup maybe at the later this month once that budget outline is released. So for the first 7 months of this year, revenues total $1.93 trillion. That's up 0.6% from the same period a year ago. Spending totals $2.27 trillion, up 0.2% from the same period last year. So spending is still higher from last year, but the revenues are also higher. I don't know about, you know, maybe I don't want to see spending increase. I want to see spending decrease. I want to see revenues decrease, but that's not going to happen either. As long as there's a taxpayer, out there, there won't be too many decreases to that revenue until nobody has any jobs. And I think that's also one thing with the retailers. We haven't seen those job losses. Thousands and thousands of retail people have lost their positions and are going to lose their positions due to all these closings of these malls and these brick-and-mortar stores. And we're just about out of time. I'm actually, my timing is perfect today. Tomorrow I do want to talk about a new Amazon building in Seattle that will include a homeless shelter. I thought it was really kind of interesting, and perhaps this will be the new way that employees will actually work. And maybe it's the company store coming back to reality in the world that we live today. So stay tuned for, make sure you tune in tomorrow. Stay tuned for Alfred Addisk and James Corbett. They'll be joining you right after the short break. Even while we sleep, we will find you acting on your best behavior. Turn your back on Mother Nature. Everybody wants to rule the world.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Talking away, I don't know what to say. Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. All your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Some of the best and most insightful, intelligent commentary you're going to find on the Internet. On geopolitics, economics, socio-political topics of interest. I've got, hello, James, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you for having me on.
Uh-huh, and see, I asked you how you're doing.
And I answered.
Yeah, but you didn't say I can't complain. I thought that was a rule on this program. You said, well, I can't complain. I got an article here from Reuters. And the headline is Mexico's 2016 murder tally exceeds those of many countries at war. All right? And they are complaining that Mexicans' militarized drug battle increasingly resembles an armed conflict. And they say since taking office in 2012, Mexican President Peña Nieto's administration has been scarred by a stubbornly weak growth, a perception of corruption, and confused tactics about how to end the decade's drug violence that has killed over 100,000 people. Now, I've gone to Mexico a couple of times. I hitchhiked down there when I was a kid, 18 years old. Me and a friend of mine, we went downstate for 3 months. I've been back a number of times. Lived on 80 cents a day the first time I went down there. I understand Mexico a little bit. I'm not a student of the rest of it, but I understand it a little bit. And I understand that there is an enormous income inequality. I had a friend, passed away about 6-8 months ago now. He has relatives, sisters, who and family members who live down in Mexico City, and they're rich. And all they do is they associate with other rich people, and what they do is they have a party at my house today, which is lavishly catered, and then they have the tomorrow we have the party at your house, which will be lavishly catered, and then the day after that we have a party at Todd's house, a producer, which will be lavishly catered. And there are people that are starving to death, or well, they're certainly hungry in Mexico. And what I'm trying to get to is this. Is the problem we see in Mexico, is it really, is this alleged drug war really about drugs? Or is this war, this alleged drug war, is this evidence of a political revolution that's attempting to overthrow the Mexican government and the Mexican oligarchy and install a government that's more friendly to the Mexican people? You follow what I'm saying?
I do, and it's a good question. I guess it goes to the heart of a lot of the social and history and context that underlies problems like this. And I can't speak to all of this because, of course, I'm not a student of Mexico. I've only ever stepped foot in Mexico once to attend the Anarco Poco conference in Acapulco a couple of years ago. So I'm not an expert by any means, but I think you are driving at what is probably the central part of this issue, which is not that it's about drugs per se in and of themselves. Yeah. It's about any area of the economy that is made into this black market is obviously going to attract the nefarious sorts that like to make money by trading in things that are outlawed by the government. And that is a manifestation of the underlying problem of Mexican society, which is very little opportunity for economic advancement. So people will often be involved in illicit manners of getting their foot in the door, economically speaking. And I think, again, that's probably a reflection of things that happen in the lower social strata of the American society as well. Again, people at the bottom rung of the economic ladder, one of the easy ways to make it up is to engage in drug dealing, things like that. Now, obviously, in Mexico, it's much more institutionalized with the different mafias, basically, that are trying to carve out their territory. But I think it's, it's more of an economic situation than it is about the drugs themselves, per se.
But is it, when we talk about an economic situation, is it even just economics? And I know that's critical, and that's the firing pin and the rest of that sort of thing in this problem, but does this go to politics in a fundamental way, where the oligarchy that runs Mexico, and it really is my understanding, Mexico's run by an oligarchy. The rich people run it, and the poor people just, they get what the crumbs that are handed out by the nobles, essentially. Is this a political problem? Are we looking at the foundation? Is the drug war fueled just by economics? Is it fueled just by greed? Or is it fueled by a need, a real need, for revolution in Mexico? Political. Is it political?
Yeah. Well, I think you're right about that. I mean, we talk about the economic disparity or otherwise between the ruling rich and the poor in a lot of the different countries, including the United States, but obviously it's much more pronounced in Mexico, where you look at the Mexican parliament, and it is not representative of the overall, demography of Mexico in any way, ethnically speaking, or social, or political, or economically speaking. And there really is that disparity that goes on. And of course, the only other challenge to that power, that political power, comes in the gangs, the mafia, the different elements of the drug war. So I think that's what we see, is that's where the resistance plays out, is in basically not exactly in anything that benefits the people. It's just in which part of what ruling sector of what class of the oligarchy is going to rule over people. So I think you're right. I mean, I think that ultimately this is a political problem that needs a more fundamental political solution than the ones that are on the table for voters that go to the ballot box every few years. But then again, I mean, it's a question of the greater historical context and what the Mexican people can do, and what they have attempted to do, and what is going on in places like Oaxaca and other places that are completely excluded from the mainstream media circles that report on Mexico, as if it's just one total whole. It would be reporting on the United States, as if Texas is the same as New York, is the same as Chicago, is the same as LA. I mean, obviously, all these places are vastly different, and I think that has to be taken into account. And same in the Mexican political situation, which is why I wouldn't get into too much of the details of it, because again, I'm not an expert by any means on Mexico.
Well, I think the next point on this is, as an impoverished peon, clearly you can't do much to fight the oligarchy. What about if you're dealing drugs and you're actually making some money? Does the sale of drugs actually empower what may turn out to be political revolutionaries before this is all over? Does it give them currency and money, and therefore they have the ability to resist the oligarchy, which they could not do as mere peons? You see what I'm saying? Is the drugs, it becomes a necessity, it becomes an opportunity for political revolution that might not be possible otherwise.
I see what you're saying. My understanding would be that what you're saying would be an aspirational thing. Wouldn't it be nice if these valiant drug dealers were leading some sort of political revolution to give power to the poor people? I think ultimately what this seems to be, at least from my perspective, is more that the money and the power and the influence that the drug war and the drug dealing affords these different mafia gangs is used to buy influence. Mexico, obviously a notoriously corrupt state with corrupt officials all the way up and down the chain of command, and I think that the money basically buys influence, or buys the ability to get officials to look the other way, or to help you out here and there. And I think that's more the way that this is looked at, that as I think in every every country to some extent, the central government is a trough to feed from, and the drug dealers get to be the first in line because they're the ones with the money to buy access to that trough.
Well, we'll watch and see, but the truth, you know, what little I know about Mexico, and I know a little bit, I've been there half a dozen times probably, but I'm again not a student, and it was years ago, but still, corruption is rampant and in fact institutionalized. They call it the mordita, meaning the little bite. And if you want to get information from somebody, you got to pay them. You got to pay them some cash. If you want directions, if you want a book, if you want whatever, everybody gets a tip. The cop gets tipped. Everybody gets a mordita, a little bribe on there. I think it's evidence of an institutionalized corruption. And is that all by itself? Does it help to keep the Mexican people in poverty? Is corruption conducive to poverty? That's what I'm getting to. I know that some people think if you're corrupt, you get to rob more people. I can steal more if I'm a crook. But to the average person, if they accept corruption, does that mean they're likely to stay locked in poverty until they begin to get some sort of moral values?
I think so, and I think that works on a number of levels, perhaps the most insidious of which is that when you internalize and accept the institutionalization of corruption, the way up that ladder is to participate in the corruption.
Yeah.
And that means if you come into access to money, or the more money you make, then the more palms you grease on your way up that ladder, and the more you basically feed into the system, so that once you actually ascend that ladder, if you actually do manage to make it up a few rungs, then you actually have an investment in that system, and you not only have internalized it, but you actively want it to continue. Especially if you get into a position of actual power, of course, then you want the corruption system to continue, because it ends up directly benefiting you. So I think that it creates the perverse false incentives, the incentives for people to actually keep the corruption in place. And that's a mindset. I think you're right. It is a mindset that has to be combated before real political change can happen at any level.
Are we saying that only immoral people can become truly prosperous?
I think that is the case. And I mean, I wouldn't put any country on a pedestal here. I think that you do get outbreaks of freedom here and there, or people with a more freedom-oriented mindset and people who are more willing to stand up to corruption and cronyism, but it doesn't always last. And I think the United States might be a good example of that. There was a time a couple of hundred years ago where people were willing to fight and die for what they thought were their principles of liberty and freedom, and we just want to be left alone. And that created one of the most prosperous societies on the face of the planet in the history of the world. And people have been coasting on that for a number of generations now. And you see the moral degradation that I think is taking place in the U.S. and elsewhere right now. And with that comes the sort of economic deterioration that we're seeing as well.
Do you think, you know, people allege that Hollywood has played a role in this moral degradation? Do you think those complaints are legitimate, exaggerated? Is there a malicious conspiracy coming out of Hollywood to make us an immoral or amoral people in order to destroy our national fiber? Or is this just, you know, just they're just making some movies and having some fun?
Well, I don't have the documents to prove what agenda may or may not be being pushed by which, you know, director or producer or company, but I think it is indisputable that the media that we consume shapes our worldview. And so it doesn't even necessarily have to be a consciously directed process, although I think to some extent it is, but even if it wasn't, the types of ideas that get fed out into the public consciousness through the media and then get regurgitated when those people who are consuming that media grow up to become media producers of their own, they feed back into that loop and it becomes a sort of spiral. And so we see that, for example, in the music industry, where, you know, 20, 30 years ago, the things that Madonna had to do to shock the world and get people to pay attention now seem extremely tame compared to the next iteration of that, you know, the Britney Spears, and then you get the Lady Gagas, and then you get the Miley Cyruses, and whatever else. Hopefully I'm getting too old to keep up with it. But yeah, I mean, so it is that kind of ratcheting up that happens, and it becomes a feedback loop where it has to push the line further and further. And it is remarkable to think about the types of standards that were in place for Hollywood movies, for example, back in the 50s, and when those blocks came off, when when people were basically allowed to go crazy, it deteriorated quite rapidly to the point where we're at right now. And there are a lot of different things that feed into that, but one of them certainly is the media and the way that it shapes our perception of what the world is.
And how we should behave. It teaches us how to conduct ourselves. It has replaced our parents to some degree. I can recall the movie Peyton Place. I think it came out in the late 50s. And oh my gosh, it was shocking. They had a second or two of a woman running in front of a vehicle at night. The headlights were on her and she was apparently naked. And you just caught it. It was indistinct. Oh my gosh, this Peyton Place. Oh my gosh. And the people who complained that it was attacking moral fiber were generally ridiculed and shown to be a bunch of, buffoons and were no fun. The people who were liberal and whatever, they were cool and they did. In retrospect, is it possible that the people who were complaining about losing our moral fiber, did they actually have a point? Should we have listened to them back in the 50s?
I think there is something to that that's playing out in the kind of slippery slope arguments that might have sounded ridiculous back then, but here we are today. And I don't think the answer to that is necessarily government control over what the media can or cannot do or say or publish, but I think we need, as individuals, to exercise control over what media we're putting into our brains in the same way that we would exercise thoughtfulness and care about what we're putting into our bodies. I mean, it's the same, in fact, perhaps even more important to what we put into our minds, because you can't unwatch what you've watched or unsee what you've seen, and that can shape our everyday behaviors. As you point out, to people going back as far back as Walter Lippmann and Edward Bernays and others were literally writing about how it was the shaping of the conscious habits of society that was the ultimate end goal of the propagandists. Because if you were able to shape people's everyday habits and behaviors, then you've got them in a way that's much more powerful than just giving them slogans or something. You've really got them the bull by the horns, as it were. And that's the state that we're in right now.
Do you think there's... Once, assuming we lose what people might call our moral fiber, all right, and we can say, all right, since World War II, it's been diminished dramatically. Can it be regained in a relatively short period of time? Is it gone forever? And we've probably only, maybe we'll have to save that question until after the break, because there's only about 15 seconds left. So I guess we'll do that. We'll find out what James thinks about regaining our moral fiber when we return on Financial Survival. I'm Alfred Addis. We're going to take a couple of commercials and we'll be right back. Please stay tuned.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. Day complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival with our guest James Corbett from the Corbett Report at CORBETTReport.com. Again, some of the best, most intelligent commentary you're going to find on the internet. We were talking about, when we broke for commercials, we were talking about moral fiber. We had mentioned and explored the idea, or at least considered the idea, that you must be a moral people to become a prosperous people. There's a requirement. You cannot be immoral and, in general, come to a happy ending. You could, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton might dispute that, but for most people, you've got to be a moral individual to become prosperous. And I was asking James if we've lost a lot of our moral principles since World War II. What are the chances that we can regain them, and can they and as the next point, can they be regained painlessly, or do we have to be put through a kind of earthly purgatory before people finally say, I think I got to start being a moral man?
Well, that's really the question, isn't it? And that the answer to that question will determine so much about the possibilities for humankind itself, not to speak too grandiose, but I think it really is. And let me relate a little story that I think relates to this. People may have heard of Bana Alabed, is a 7-year-old purporting to be from East Aleppo, who is tweeting and has hundreds of thousands of followers on Twitter with her 7-year-old commentary about what's happening in Syria. Basically, she's a propaganda tool that's being used by her parents as a mouthpiece to pump the why won't someone come in and bomb this country to save it line that is so popular with the U.S. establishment, which is why she's been featured on CNN reading a teleprompter and all of this kind of really nonsense. I mean, it's horrific to think this 7-year-old is being used in this manner, but at any rate, that's what it is. And so, as a result of the sort of exposure of the PR aspects of this 7-year-old's Twitter account, there was a kind of parody Twitter account set up by someone saying they were, I think, a 4-year-old from Syria or something that's tweeting about the war and making parody tweets like, I'm 4 years old and today my nursery school was bombed. And many children died, and I'm crying tears about this. Also about manspreading on public transport in New York City or something. Pointing out the kind of ridiculous concerns that seem to be occupying or preoccupying a lot of the American consciousness at the time when, you know, there are real concerns that people face on a daily basis of real death and destruction going on, and the American people and people in many developed countries, to be fair, seem so sheltered from that reality that they're starting to find ever more ridiculous things to get outraged or upset or consumed by. And I think the reason that kind of parody is so funny is because there is this kind of underlying idea that we've lost connection with whatever it is that our ancestors had to struggle with to find even the modicum of freedom that we enjoy today, such as it may be disappearing. The kind of incredible struggles that previous generations have gone through, and real sacrifices that have been made, and real warfare and bloodshed and all of that. And we're so sheltered from that, which is a wonderful thing to think about. We've grown up in this world where we don't have to face these kinds of horrific things, but it certainly does make for an ever decreasingly realistic sense of what the problems in the world really are for most people. And the danger of that is the sort of mentality is, well, what we need is a good war to get people awake again. You know, people need something to fight for and bloodshed, and they need to feel that sacrifice and that pain in order to understand what's really important again. And I fear that that's the case. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. Maybe we can, as human beings, find a way to give meaning to our lives without disintegrating into bloodshed and violence, and, well, people have to die, and we have to feel all this pain in order to understand what's real in life. I'd like to think that we don't have to go through that, but at any rate, we're going through a civilizational change at this point where that's going to come to a head one way or another, and it looks more and more like it will come to some sort of military confrontation, doesn't it, just given the proliferation of events around the world that lead in that direction.
Well, when you say military confrontation, are we talking about something akin to World War III, or are we talking about another skirmish?
Well, I mean, in the context of what we're talking about here, making people, realize and snap out of their kind of petty concerns that have over-consumed them, I think we'd be looking at any rate, something that actually affected people in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Not one of these petty skirmishes that basically are fought through drone warfare or whatever, where maybe a few servicemen die, maybe. But something, on the scale of what the kind of ravaging effects of World War II or something like that.
You're living in Japan. You're close to Korea. Reasonably close. I'm sure you're, are you 500 miles away? How far are you from North Korea right now?
That's actually a good question. I haven't done the math of how many miles I am, but at any rate, I'm certainly within shooting distance.
Yeah, I understand that. So you've got a different perspective on this. You've got a place to look and see what's happening where you're closer than we are, than I am for sure. What do you see coming out of the Korean Peninsula?
At this precise moment, right now, there is at least a tiny glimmer of hope that this may actually resolve in, or at least progress in some manner that's better than what we've been seeing in the last few months, and that's because of the election of the new president, Moon Jae-in, who campaigned on and seems to be following through on promises to actually restore the so-called Sunshine Policy, which is basically a South Korean political policy of engagement with North Korea rather than drawing battle lines and talking tough, which is what the previous president was doing. So this new president is appointing people to his cabinet who have direct experience with North Korea, have even visited, or even, I think one of them actually said they lived in North Korea for 2 years. I have to get on the details of that. But at any rate, people who know something about the North Koreans and are committed to trying to open dialogue of some sort rather than, as I say, the kind of animosity and trading barbs that have been taking place in recent years. That is, I think, a real reason for hope, because people who only follow the 24-hour news cycle probably will not remember, but back in 1994, there was an agreement signed for the denuclearization of Korea, and towards that, there was significant progress in the years following that. In the late 90s, the South and North Korea there was a definite detente, and there were closer relations as part of the Sunshine Policy. That was derailed in 2002, deliberately so by the Bush administration, and the effect of that derailing was the ramping up of the North Korean nuclear program, and obviously the successful completion of their first nuclear warheads. So we know what direction the talking tough and the battle lines goes, and we can see that some sort of thawing of relations may actually be possible by engagement rather than disengagement. So there is actually some glimmer of opportunity for something approaching hope at this precise moment if Moon Jae-in is allowed to pursue this policy in defiance, really, of the current administration in Washington and elsewhere.
Kim Jong-un appears to the West, at least, to be something like a rabid dog. And in the event that we have this new sunshine policy coming out of South Korea, is Kim likely to respond positively, or will he insist on the need to be able to launch more ICBMs. And part of the question here, part of the implication, did Kim's apparent rabidness, was it conducive to restoring the Sunshine Policy?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I think that feeds into the question about the cyclical nature of this ramping up of the North Korean threat, which happens usually every spring, usually coincidentally, right after the U.S. and South Korea practice their invasion of the Korean Peninsula in a annual military exercise they hold every single spring. And that's exactly when North Korea starts talking tough and sending out all these messages. So I think there's some relation there. So it's the dog that barks that gets fed, and this happens on a regular basis enough that there is something to that. But I think that the change... And if anything, that a real, true attempt at engagement, if that was positively met by North Korea, would change that cyclical process. Rather than having to bark in order to get fed, I think that might change the relationship into one where there doesn't need to be that bark in order to get fed. Now, that's the aspiration, I think, of this process, and whether or not it will or could achieve that will ultimately be seen by, you know, what eventuates on the North Korean side, whether they would be open to that, and whether such a thing would be scuttled by the U.S. and China and other interests that like to meddle in what's happening on the Korean Peninsula. But the point is, we won't know until it is tried, and it hasn't been tried with Kim Jong-un. So we really don't know what kind of leader he really is, because no one has, at this point, really attempted thoroughgoing engagement with North Korea under his leadership.
You wrote an article... published an article on your blog called "What Are You Going to Be When You Grow Up?" But you have the image, we already talked about this before the program began, but you have an interesting image that opened of yourself, the picture. They caught you just at exactly the right moment to catch kind of a peculiar gleam in your eye, which reminded me, as I told you, Dr. Strangelove, Peter Sellers a little bit. But it was an interesting argument. What are you going to be when you grow up? I point out that people would ask me when I was a child, young boy, what are you going to be when you grow up? Well, we had an answer for that. You wanted to be a fireman. You wanted to be an astronaut. You wanted to be, a heavy equipment operator. We had, because the occupations were there and were going to be there. But you point out, right now, whatever career we choose may not even exist. If a child chooses, well, I want to be this, it might not even exist 10 years, 15, 20 years from now. That career may be gone. And what career he gets may be something that does not yet even exist. And you explore this idea, which I think is interesting, and you use it to raise a couple of questions. What does this say about the ability of people to manage or direct the economy if no one knows what's even going to be here 10, 15, 20 years from now? And you ask, what if I told you no one could direct the economy and that was a good thing? What if I told you that the greatest trick the ruling class ever pulled was getting us to believe that we needed them in the first place, presumably to direct our affairs? Got about 3 minutes left. You want to expand on that a little bit?
Yes, well, obviously, this is a topic that I've been thinking about more and more in recent years, or really in recent months, as my boy is now 4 years old, and but so he's a typical 4-year-old boy, and he's interested in construction vehicles and in trucks and trains and things, and so I jokingly say to him, oh, do you want to be a construction worker when you grow up? Do you want to be a truck driver? Do you want to be a train conductor? Whatever it is that we're looking at the moment. And he says, yeah. And I say, well, I'm not sure that'll exist when you're ready to join the workforce. And it's true. There's so many of those types of jobs where I'm really not convinced there'll be jobs for him by the time he reaches that. Maybe he can program the driverless cars or whatever it is that will be the job of the future. But and it's a real phenomenon that's happening now. I mean, obviously there have been changes in society before. The Industrial Revolution and others have changed the nature of work for many people, but I think it's accelerating at this point, and obviously I think apparently so. So again, there are negative aspects to this. That there is something comforting about having a somewhat predictable life where you can join a company and work for it for 50 years and retire with a golden handshake and, you know, have done your part. That that concept is pretty much shattered at this point, and it can be a scary thing. But I think the flip side of this is that we should not desire, or we shouldn't at least hold the illusion that any political messiah is going to come down and direct the economy, because the economy isn't a thing. It is the spontaneous interactions of millions or billions of people who are interacting in whatever ways that are available to them to try to meet their needs. And I think the more we expect that someone is even capable of directing that, it's not a question of this person is, oh, I prefer this person to direct the economy rather than that one. No one is capable of doing that, and nor should they attempt to do so, because intervention generally only ever screws things up. So, having said that, I think the argument is one for a different understanding of the economy than what we have. And the term that I like to use is catalaxy, which comes from an obscure form of economics. But basically, it's the idea of that the economy, as we understand it, is really just the sum total of interactions between free people, and they are not, it is not a thing. It is not a process to be directed. It is not an engine that needs refueling or things like this, the types of metaphors we use to talk about the economy.
Then what you're implying is that the more government interferes, the less prosperous the economy is going to be, and you've got about 10 seconds to answer.
That is always and forever the case, but it's impossible to prove the negatives. So there will always be people who say, well, if we didn't have government, this or that. But you can't prove the negative. But I am 100% convinced that government intervention only skews the market. It never fundamentally helps it.
All right, James, thanks very much for being on the program. I always enjoy talking to you. I want to thank everyone in the audience for listening. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Todd, the producer, and James Corbin. Bye-bye.
Hey, ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.